and they're going to talk a little bit about the San Francisco art world and what they do. You guys want to introduce yourselves?
My name is Stephen Wolf, and my gallery is actually called Stephen Wolf Fine Arts, I think. Nice research.
Thanks, sorry.
Yeah. I'm a hamburger. I run a website called artbusiness.com.
So off the top, I mean, let's just get a little background on you, Stephen. How long have you owned and run a gallery in San Francisco?
I've run two galleries. The first opened about 10 years ago, and it was devoted primarily to showing obscure artists that I rescued, obscure artists from the past that I sort of rescued from the dustbin of history, and tried to breathe new life into them. And then in 2003, I opened the gallery that I currently run, which has more of a traditional contemporary art program. And I still sell like the sort of historical material. I just do it as a side gig out of the back room.
All right. What about yourself? What do you find yourself doing here?
I primarily appraise and do consulting both with artists and people who collect. And I run around and cover the local San Francisco art scene.
Okay. How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing the local art scene part for a little over 3 years, and everything else, grand total, 30 years.
30 years?
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It is a long time.
Have you a
switch?
What have you learned in that time, Helen?
Heavy lifting is bad. I've learned that, so I try to do all the cognitive stuff now. But I started out doing, I've been a rare book dealer. I have bought and sold vintage clothing. I started out doing flea markets and running around a variety of different incarnations. Selling antique art, early California art, early American art.
Nice.
That sort of thing.
Alan and I actually share some aspects of our past. I started out as a newspaper reporter, a background in 19th century German philosophy. But when I came to San Francisco, pretty much. Are there any others? It's another tradition I'm not aware of. But when I came to San Francisco originally, my first foray into the art world was through the thrift stores, and all the paintings that I found to sell, I found in the thrift stores. And I know, like I learned shortly after, that the artist Jim Shaw had sort of made a book about it, and it was kind of like a joke on the paintings that you find in the thrift store, and you know, that they're both good and bad, but it was sort of a joke on it, but I was doing it for real. Selling them because I thought they were good paintings.
And you did all right with that?
I did, because back then, it was before the sort of resale thrift store business had become professionalized. It was before old Levi's jeans were selling for, $10,000. It was before in San Francisco, obscure artists from the past brought a lot of money, and so nobody thought to go in and just dig through whatever, mess of a pile there was in these places. I mean, it was sort of a cult thing, and then probably 5 years later, you'd see kids with college educations going in there, but before that, it was just like people who had nowhere else to go or do that sort of work. And back then, you could find amazing things. And one of my first days on the job, I found like this important Nathan Oliveira collage.
Are you serious?
Totally serious. I mean, I in fact made more money doing that than I do in my fancy gallery.
For those out there, I did the same thing, except I brought it out. I would just hop in the car and drive around the country, and then later I would fly and draw a circle somewhere around a car and see what I could dig up. But I have similar things. I have a Gordon Cook watercolor that I purchased for $5 somewhere at Berkeley a long time ago. Things that were just absurdly cheap. And I suppose those things still happen from time to time.
They do. I know people who still do it. There's been a shakeout in that business recently. It attracted a lot of people because they heard about the, you know, treasure hunt finds, and there were just more people in the sort of resale business as a whole than there are now. And I guess the economy took a dip in 2000 when the dot-com bubble burst, and it started to thin out. But you can, you know, I still get like fish story phone calls from people who tell me about the big one either that got away or that they caught.
The ones I know who do the best, they're just extremely knowledgeable. They're like, you know, world-class print dealers, for example, pick Rembrandts off of eBay. I mean, there are these people. They're just the absolute tops of their fields. That's where it's at now. It's all scholarly.
That's true. The action isn't so much found by getting in your car and running around to brick-and-mortar places. I think there's a lot of treasure hunting to be done online. A lot of it has shifted there into virtual space.
So you guys have both been in San Francisco, it seemed, for quite a while, and have had a hands-on chance to not only see but deal with the dot-com bubble burst here. Can you tell us a little bit about how it personally affected both of you?
Well, the parties were a lot shabbier after. I never went to such unbelievable. I thought I was so nowhere because I would go to a party that literally cost $50,000, $75,000, $100,000, and I just wondered where all the money was coming from. I didn't quite put it together until the whole thing fell apart. That it was people were investing, and the people who were running the companies had no clue what they were doing. So they brought all the most expensive stuff, threw a bunch of parties, printed up some T-shirts, and thought that money would fall on their heads. So it was a great run while it was going. A lot of artists lost their studio spaces and that sort of thing. And eventually, it came to artists actually holding protest parties. And I still have a few pieces of memorabilia left over from that. Some of these subscription protests, they would print up serigraphs and have these parties as they just were fighting for their lives. But that's all over now.
I think I must have lost some customers. I didn't have a big .com, you know, WorldExit.com millionaires to draw upon. I had some extraordinary experiences dealing with .com millionaires who were like service people, like secretaries who had, were, you know, the 10th person hired at a company who were paid originally in stock options, and they were people who you'd never expect to see in a gallery, and they had all this money, and they didn't have that kind of savoir faire about dealing with art, about being in a gallery space. And so it was incredibly entertaining to have a person like that with all the money to spend and no idea how to even ask questions about it, or what to look at, and how to deal with it. And those people, of course, disappeared. And I do remember that for a spell after the bubble burst, like when all those people were relocating, that the garage sales went downhill because they all seemed to shop in the same three stores, they bought the same Brad furniture, they read the same books and listened to the same bad music, and that's the crap that would show up on the street in front of their sad little garage sales.
Oh, they also had these, a lot of them bought these fabulous Herman Miller office chairs, and I should have picked one up while they were still. I just thought they'd be for sale forever and ever and ever and ever. Somebody out there, one of the most pathetic ones was one of these wacky art sites. They were selling a Groves Artist Encyclopedia, which they had probably paid about $8,000 for. They were trying to get $250 for it, $500, something like that, just anything. It was pathetic at the end. And there were lots of very unqualified people who had come here with high hopes, and off they went back to wherever they came from.
So to switch more to present day, with the dot-com seeming to come back a little bit, what would you say the San Francisco is looking like now as far as the art world? I mean, Alan, you keep a pretty close tie and a close pulse on what's going on. As a friend told me, if there's somebody having a basement show in Berkeley, he's there.
I don't go to
So, yeah, I, you know, there's some pretty good local art sites. I think the best one is would probably be Finkel Face. He really, he does an incredible job of covering the local arts. He was now beginning to expand out. That would be John Tripp, by the way. Expand out into other venues and doing interviews with people from New York and LA and that sort of thing. And it's for 30 and under, primarily. I don't see a lot of really good websites that do a lot of good coverage of, like, the cross-section of everything, though.
Did you ask about websites or the scene in general?
Scene in general, but websites are definitely part of the scene.
Websites I've actually looked into a lot recently because when I first opened, when I first started showing young artists and having a real gallery program, I had a really hard time getting people to come down and write about my shows. And so I looked around to try to figure out, like, well, what's the problem? And I realized there's very little art writing in San Francisco. And if you look at other cities, you see that they have, like, you know, big cities. You see that they usually have, like, one or two or three really juicy online magazines about the art scene. And, of course, you know, lots of other smaller publications, actually printed publications. And so, like, I like Finkel Face. I think that's, it's a pretty fairly narrowly focused on a certain kind of audience and a certain kind of art production. There seems to be a general absence of good online art coverage and, obviously, printed art coverage. I mean, you've got, you know, just the Chronicle, really, The Guardian and some Blue Moon and NSF Weekly. I mean, they produce small things, but I can't blame them. Galleries don't take ads in these publications, so there's no financial support for it, but nonetheless, there's, you know, if you're trying to take the pulse of it, there's a huge kind of lack of art coverage in the media. And the scene, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a good person to summarize what's going on with the scene. It seems pretty active. I think, here's something, I think that the schools are driving the scene in an interesting way. There have been, you know, there are really good people running the schools now. And there's a lot of energy and interest in, like, Arts Theater Institute at CCA, Berkeley, SF State, Mills. When you start adding it up, there's a lot of stuff happening in the schools, and I think that, you know, I find the commercial gallery world to be fairly, and I don't want to say stale, because there's some really good galleries here, but there's a lot, there's a tradition of very conservative buying habits here, and the commercial gallery has formed to satisfy that appetite. And it's the schools and the fact that they're now gaining some international superstars to run and teach at them that are driving and will drive the sort of, like, interesting stuff that happens here, I think.
And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I tend to agree about the more traditional 49 Geary Street and those sorts of the more established galleries. There can be interesting things, there can be less interesting things. I like the, I agree about the art schools driving the scene because there are just so many creative people here and so you have a lot of experimentation. You have a lot of these little galleries that open up and close up within a few months and a lot of it is driven by that. People who come here, they like it, they get involved. So San Francisco is becoming a very arty city and attractive to lots of creative people. And I kind of get a feeling that the government, the local politic is picking up on it gradually, like with Mercarini and Matt Gonzalez before him and their art shows at City Hall. And you kind of see a lot, you know, more stuff, more attention being paid. I don't know about money being thrown out quite yet, but certainly the scene is very interesting at the lower levels.
I mean, one of the things when I talk to local artists that definitely stands out. I mean, this is nothing new. Obviously, everybody deals with this. This place is so fucking expensive that you can't live here and make art. So people move to East Bay, obviously. And do you guys spend much time in East Bay, like the First Fridays, etc.?
I've started going to that event. It's a hassle to get over there, but it's 8 minutes over the bridge, man. I don't know. I can't do it.
I've been to it. It's pretty decent. I mean, they have a good scene there. They have a lot of artists. It's rough to
get people to get over there and then get the attention on it. But there's a little strip of galleries there along Telegraph Avenue between about 20th and 40th or so. Worth seeing.
And Lobot, do you think that that San Francisco will eventually drive out the artist and they'll just permanently end up in Oakland?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the artist living in Oakland and showing here. I mean, it's if you go to New York, largely the artists that you meet live in Brooklyn and might show in New York. The problem with Oakland from a gallery standpoint is the shows aren't any, the ones that I've seen have been terrible. Otherwise, Oakland should be the Brooklyn of San Francisco, and for some reason it's not yet. I bet it does eventually turn into that, but something's got to happen. Some spanking has got to happen to make that happen.
Are you the man to spank?
No, I'm not. I'm the man to get spanked. I'm looking for a spanking.
You heard that live.
This is the harsh reality. First of all, that art production is for the most part still something that comes from the luxury class, and it always has, for 500 years. So we shouldn't really lament the idea that the places where art flourishes happen to be places where things are totally expensive, because it's not by accident. The two are totally related. The kids who make are generally rich kids who come from, comfortable families.
I'll tell you, regarding living here in the expensive climate, there are artists who are getting together and buying buildings. I was just talking to one, trying to figure out where his space is. But they're going down towards Potrero, down, way down,
Dogpatch?
Yeah, Dogpatch, right down below that, Yeah, Bayview, places like that. I mean, they're starting to infiltrate there. And some of them are, there's a number of warehouse, not a number, but a good handful of warehouse studio spaces that have opened up, two, three, four floor spaces with anywhere from, say, 30 to 50, 75 separate studios in them. So the artists aren't going to leave. They'll figure something out.
Well, it would be great if someone figured out a model to get band artists together so they actually can buy property. Because in studio rent, they can probably, a bunch of artists willing to rent share studio space, by the time they finish paying their rent, they can probably own the thing. And so it just requires someone with financial acumen. I mean, I don't think that the art schools spend a lot of time teaching business to these kids.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's all they teach. I can't. It's one or the other. Either there's no business taught or there's nothing but business taught. I can't tell. But, because art is so closely related to real estate, if the artist can gain control over their real estate situation, you never know how that would affect studio practice. It probably make them lazy and, ruin the art.
One thing that I definitely wanted to ask both you guys is, what is hot right now? Who do you like, Alan? Who do you, in all of San Francisco, who do you think's banging right now?
I just never even think that way. One day it'll be one artist, another day it'll be the next. I just keep an eye on people over the long term.
You can't tell.
I mean, they'll do a mediocre show, they'll do a fabulous show. When I'm reviewing the shows and when I'm going to all this stuff, it all turns into a blur, and when I like it, I say so, and when I don't like it, I do. But I don't really pick long-term favorites. I suppose if I had to name a couple of names, maybe
I refuse to his stuff. I like Andrew Schultz, who seems to be off and about all over the country now. He certainly moved up real fast, and he's very good. And I just have to sort of think about more people beyond that. But Kim Coggan, the Kim Coggan show down there at White Wells right now, that White Wells, shooting gallery complex there. They put up some pretty interesting stuff on a regular basis. Not for everybody, but always worth a look, and the quality is almost always very respectable.
Al, you want to play Shag?
Shag. I never met the guy.
You're getting up to the right end.
The paintings are okay. Yeah, but no, I'm not going to plug Shag.
I like his stuff. Good. I tend to gravitate towards artists that entertain a narrow cult-like audience, and no one ever seems to talk about as if they were the next big thing or if they were hot. In this town, the artists who win the Sika Award tend to be thought of as hot. The artists who are included in the Bay Area Now show tend to be thought of as hot. The artists who show at Jack Hanley's gallery often get, tagged for being hot. I was at the Vernissage, the San Francisco Art Institute MFA show the other night, and there was a woman who had a crazy buzz. I can't remember her name. She's an Iranian born artist, and there was a real buzz going on around her work.
What did her stuff look like?
It was self-proclaimed self-portraits of her, multiple images of her clustered in a small part of the paper or canvas with a lot of empty space around.
I like those. I gave those, and I like it.
Then she's hot. She's
it. That was it.
I just thought about that. Yeah. I guess if I talk long enough, I'll get something right.
But you personally, though, what do you like?
I'm omnivorous when it comes to art. That I'm like the Gary Winogrand camera that's on the street falling in and out of love 100 times a day with beautiful women. Half of all the art I seem to like. Imagine hanging over my bed in my bedroom, and then forget about it 30 seconds later. So I'm just like, I'm so changeable. In terms of the artists that I like, I like so many of them. That just to single out a few doesn't even feel right.
That's kind of unfair.
It is a little unfair, but then
you're like picking stocks.
If it has an impact, first of all, if it's well done, it's got to be well done. If it's shabbily put together, I don't care. It's just, it just doesn't pass muster. No matter how compelling the cognitive aspect of it is, the context. And then, if it has an impact, I don't know whether I read about it, or if it even is good enough to make me want to read about it. Those are the sorts of things. People have to think about that when they make art. Just basically, it's like a compelling first line in a novel. You got to hook the viewer instantly, or else they just go, oh, I like that, that's nice, and then they move on to the next thing. So that's kind of that's what makes me stop and look at something, and I don't care who makes it.
The other places that people associate hotness with are the California Biennial, which is, I guess, at the Orange County Museum. It happens every other year. And what are the other annual summaries of Borough art that kind of are indexes of hotness?
Indexes of hotness.
I kind of go along with that. I don't know what shows interesting stuff. There are a few galleries that consistently, Catherine Clark, Link.
Catherine Clark show right now. What do you guys think about that?
I haven't been there. What is it?
It's, I forget his name, but it's
Travis Somerville.
Yeah, that's it.
I like the dude because he's brave enough to paint it. That's another one of my criteria for do I like it.
He painted
to step up to the plate and let's see what you think, and that's what he did there.
What's been painted there?
Wright was like a black guy in a bow holding Bush's hands or something like that.
Steve Wright found Jonathan Holofernes. Jonathan Holofernes?
Yeah. It was a reference to Katrina.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the commentary on Katrina with a bowling pin set up, like Ku Klux Klan hats set up as bowling pins with a black slave ball.
It's just that it
doesn't sound like that.
Still, he seems kind of rampant, I think, with his upbringing in the rural South and the, you know, the stereotypic activity. That his work is just, you know, completely infused with it.
And his paintings are emotionally surface, shiny, kind of beautiful, rich.
Sort of made after, you know, takeoffs on the old, you know, master period compositions.
My own taste runs to dry, very dry, humorous, politically engaged, a bit anarchic. So I find didactic kind of, even if it's, unless it's so over the top, the meaning starts to break up. I find that stuff, it can be interesting, but you digest it once, and then there's hardly any reason to go back for it.
You had that guy over at your gallery, the guy that made the little Fender amp, and I went in there and I looked around and I said, what's all this crap scattered on the floor? And it was actually, every piece was a sculpture of, the guy made a sculpture of a Fender amp. It was so real, you couldn't tell the difference.
It was a painting.
Yeah, painting, three-dimensional painting, whatever. You look around the back and it's a bunch of canvases that are kind of, you know, fastened together. You also had that collage artist from Houston. He was good.
Yeah.
That was what happened to him.
I think he's going the same place that he was.
I'm going to jump in real quick. One of my personal favorites that you have currently at your gallery is, and I forget the artist's name, sorry, shame on me, but a guy who made a sleeping bag.
Matthew Gehring.
Yeah.
MFA graduate from CCU, I guess, in 2005. His work is very interesting. I think he's has some kind of extended residency at the Headlands, and the majority of work that I've seen is sewn. And what he did in this work is he took an off-the-rack sleeping bag, disassembled it so that you could sort of open it, but so that the zipper only goes down two-thirds of the way, but he must have undone the seam so that he could sew the whole thing front and back in with a kind of mummified sort of spiritual figure, so that it makes it a real, like, looks almost like a dream machine. You slip in and you drift away.
I just want to plug one show. There's a great show at the Luggage Store at some, I forget the guy's, I think his name is Kintundu or something like that. It's at the Luggage Store. He makes these things. He makes working turntables and incorporates other musical instruments, other aspects of other musical instruments into them, like strings or things that you play, like piano kind of
key things. Hammer dulcimer turntables.
Yeah, and then he plays them. And those are really, I think he's at the Headlands. That's what reminded me when you mentioned the Headlands. That's a great and unusual show. Some of the best ones I've seen there.
Just as we're wrapping it up here, but just to let everybody know out in the listening audience, what are you guys' websites again? Aaron, what's yours?
Artbusiness.com. And that's a San Francisco Art Opening section. You would just click on the San Francisco Art Openings link on the homepage.
Okay. And Stephen?
StephenWolfFineArts.com. You can see the shows and the artists that we deal with, and this sort of inventory we have of older blue chip stuff too.
Okay. Thank you guys both very much. This has been Frank Brown. My name is Zephyr, and I've had Alan Bamber from Art Business on, and Steven Wolf from Steven Wolf Fine Arts.
Thank you.